Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for more traditional exercise such as weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447. Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, April 16th, 2014, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Jim Flink and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, 1 year after the Boston Marathon bombings, the Boston Globe nabs a Pulitzer Prize for its coverage. As we mark the anniversary of the attack, what are we seeing in that commemorative coverage now? The battle over the Comcast-Time Warner merger is brewing on Capitol Hill. We'll talk about Al Franken's one-man mission to put a stop to it. And a major daily newspaper nixes reader comments on its website until it can find a way to silence the trolls. There's a lot more hopefully we'll get to as well, but let's start with a story coming out of Santa Barbara, California. That's where an annual street party known as Deltopia turned into an all-out street riot. Two KEYT TV photographers were caught in the melee and kept rolling.
I'm just worried about the bricks, man.
Yeah, you gotta watch out, dude.
Those stop signs have been torn out of the ground.
The station aired this video and then notified viewers that it would be sharing the video with the sheriff's department and district attorney's office. News organizations are often subpoenaed for images that they've captured during the course of news gathering. How common is it to just turn it over without that official legal request?
It's not common at all. I mean, usually they either wait for the request to come from the sheriff's department or the prosecutor's office, or they wait for the subpoena to come. And then they make a decision along with, after consulting with their attorneys as to whether or not they want to do that. As a news organization, you can lose some of your credibility by being seen as an arm of law enforcement or an arm of the government. So for them to do this right off the bat, that's very unusual.
Conversely, it's interesting because for television news in particular, so much of its coverage has turned to crime. And there is this relationship that you're building out on the street, not just with the hierarchy of police organizations, but with the cop on the street. And the cop on the street is paying attention to the way that you cover stories and basically is saying, you know, hey, if you show yourself as unfriendly to us in terms of how you cover the news, then we may be less friendly with you when it comes to where we stretch crime scene tape and that kind of thing. And so it is a difficult situation, only exacerbated by the fact that both reporters in this case were related to someone within law enforcement.
So the reporter involved here is the daughter of the sheriff. There's another reporter involved who is married to a judge. That part not made completely clear by the TV station.
When you have conflicts of interest along those lines, you need to make it clear to the audience that, you know, that these people were involved. They have connections to law enforcement or to the government, but that does not factor into our decision. Now, whether or not the public's going to believe you when you say that, you know, who knows? But I think to go back to what you're talking about, Jim, I think you're absolutely right in terms of there is this sort of quid pro quo when you're a police reporter out there or you're a journalist out there covering these kinds of events and the officers know you. They're going to expect a certain level of cooperation because they're cooperating to help you get your story. So there is some of that there. But when you have the news director or the editor making the decision to turn over everything, that's when things get a little bit more complicated.
And the other thing is, you know, a lawyer or someone from the police department can very quickly call up a news director and say, hey, you know, we're going to subpoena this information. And in fact, the news director says that in this case, that they're going to do that.
Right. He expects that to happen anyway. So he's acting preemptively and just
But that said, you wait for that. And mm-hmm. and you do it if for no other reason. You don't want retaliation, or you don't want some sort of, for it to appear as if you're too cozy with the law enforcement. You go ahead and you wait for that. And this is a dance that newsrooms and various law enforcement agencies do over and over again. What I thought was interesting was that they said on the air, we're going to turn this footage over.
And the other thing is, you're setting a precedent. So this was a riot. Who's to say that that's not going to be expected in other news gathering mm-hmm. operations that right. you do that involve government and law enforcement, that they're going to expect you to turn that over? You've set a precedent now. So they're not going to just call you and ask you. They're just going to show up and say, hey, can we get that tape?
So this station is setting a precedent with the law enforcement that it's cooperating with at this point. What kind of a precedent is it setting for stations and news agencies across the country that there might be a similar expectation? Are they making it harder on the rest of us?
Well, I mean, yeah, there's going to be this level of expectations, but I'm pretty sure that there's some news directors right there in that market that are saying, we're not going to do that. Mm-hmm. If you want it from that station, you can go ahead and get it from them, but we're not going to engage in that kind of quid pro quo with law enforcement or the government.
But I do see more and more crime beat reporters in particular that are getting so close to their sources that there does become to be this blurred line that what is information that I should provide to a source or to anyone? What should I protect? What should I keep close to my vest? And where do I become cheerleader or supporter as opposed to impartial observer?
Or collaborator, even if you
Correct.
Go back to the days of when Dateline NBC was producing To Catch a Predator.
Mm-hmm. Right,
and
right.
working to directly lure potential abusers.
Right. right.
Right. Into a net right there. Well, the Boston Globe was among the publications to walk away with a Pulitzer Prize this week, recognized for its breaking news coverage of the Boston Marathon bombings. 1 year after the attack, we're seeing a lot of reporting focusing on triumph and recovery. How much of the coverage have you been watching in the last day or two?
I watched a little bit of it yesterday, and in particular, I watched last night when they basically talked about the fact that there was this disturbed person that left mm-hmm. several backpacks mm-hmm. that the police had to go in and basically blow up.
Yeah.
And the sort of fear and anger that brought about. I think that the news coverage of that was concise and to the point and didn't dwell on it as much and focused more on the festivities that were going on and the triumph and the whole slogan of Boston Strong and that sort of thing. So I think that the coverage overall over the entire weekend leading up to that was pretty well done.
All right, I'm similar to Ernest. You know, I find that some anniversary coverage tends to be very overdone in the 24/7 news cycle. And I'm not saying that it doesn't have value. And certainly for the city of Boston and for the country as a whole, it has a great deal of value. That having been said, personally, I don't tune into that much. And part of that is that I was in a newsroom working on the day that this happened mm-hmm. and was immersed in this event. And so in some respects, I think maybe I got so much of it at the outset that maybe revisiting it was difficult for me.
Personally. I know personally I have that issue after mm-hmm. having worked in a newsroom on 9/11. Whenever there's 9/11 commemorative coverage, I'm as far away from a TV or a newspaper or the internet as I can be. So
on that particular subject.
Right.
Yeah.
Because we do have those sensitivities that come with being as close to it as we were. There was a little bit of a kerfuffle that happened with Meet the Press this weekend. What happened there? Because it's an interesting...
Yeah, one of the guests that Meet the Press tried to line up, Adrian Haslett, is a survivor of the Boston bombings and, in fact, lost a limb. And she had agreed to come on the show, according to her, and under the stipulation that, A, that they talked about her as a survivor and not a victim, and B, that they didn't mention the perpetrators' names. And according to her, Meet the Press said, that's fine, we'll try to make that happen. And then when she arrived at the studio, they said, you know, we really can't make that happen, so we're sorry, at which point she left, and she refused to be on the show.
Is a request like that reasonable to expect to have a source? There's usually some negotiation that goes on between somebody doing a big interview and the person being interviewed. Is a request like that reasonable? And did NBC, if they said, we will try... Did they make a reasonable concession in how they then communicated back? Or should she have walked out the door?
I don't know. I just find it difficult to honor that request when you're talking about something mm-hmm. with this kind of magnitude where you actually know who actually committed it. One of them died. The other one is in jail awaiting trial. You're going to have to mention their names. And what I didn't see in the coverage of this particular incident involving this survivor was why was mentioning the name so horrific to her? I mean, I would want to know that, and maybe that's something that's private that we shouldn't know. But when you're going to make a request like that, I think it's also good to say, here's why I don't want that.
I think her point of view was you're giving them what they originally sought with some sort of fame or whatever. And, you know, to your point, Amy, I don't think it's realistic to make that promise. Mm-hmm. And as you said, there are negotiations with sources right. all the time about what are you going to do? What are you going to ask me? You know, and at some point you have to say, I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to ask you, or no, I can't honor that request. And if that means that's a deal killer, that's a deal killer. And if, in fact, Meet the Press did make her that promise and then reneged on that promise, that was never a good idea in the first place. You can't get somebody to come into that situation.
And according to Meet the Press, or the officials of Meet the Press, they said, we're not sure we can do that.
We'll try, but they didn't make a specific stand.
But they shouldn't have.
They shouldn't have done that.
You're
either.
Right.
No, I agree
because
with you on
it's
that.
Too. It's too important.
I mean,
to
when
the story.
You when you're looking exactly when you when this is an issue you're going to be talking about in a round table setting yeah. where there are three or four other people involved, are you making that same agreement? Mm-hmm. Are you going to them and saying, we're going to have this conversation, but please don't mention the names? I mean, now all of them have to agree to it, too. It just gets very convoluted, and it loses focus of what it is you're there to be talking about to begin with.
And that still is part of the story. When you said that Tsarnaev is going to be on trial come fall,
right.
that is the next biggest increment, is what happens as that moves through the legal right, process.
Right. And what kind of an impact that's going to have on the city of Boston, the survivors, and others.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's back up a little bit. When I introduced this topic, I had mentioned the Boston Globe had won a Pulitzer for its coverage on this. Other Pulitzers also handed out on Monday. Any surprises there?
I didn't see any surprises. I think we could have predicted that mm-hmm. Eric Snowden and the NSA
yeah,
stories were going to be
Snowden
the ones
stuff.
That were going to win. I think we could predict that Boston mm-hmm. Marathon was going to win. I think that the one surprise that I did see was that there was no Pulitzer for feature writing. And that's happened in the past, mm-hmm. but it's been a long past. And they couldn't come to a consensus. And I sort of wonder, because I've read a lot of pretty interesting feature stories out there, I wonder who the finalists were and where did the vote go? How did it wind up not being a consensus on the finalists that were there?
Here was my takeaway. Not that there were any surprises, but how much good long form investigative journalism is going on right now. I mean, I think that there are some in our profession who sort of malign the present state of affairs in journalism. But what I think we're seeing time and time again is how much really excellent, invested long form journalism there is. I was looking at the finalists and I mm-hmm. was thinking, man, would I hate to be a judge in this competition with as much good stuff as was being done. And that's very encouraging.
Yeah, the one thing that I did like was the fact that the one long form journalism piece that did win was the one that looked at food stamps. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a very interesting piece. It talks about the inequality issue that's been bandied about for over a year and a half now that the president has been bringing back over and over and over again. And that's the kind of journalism I think that has the potential, along with the national security and NSA mm-hmm. issues, that has the potential to have longer legs yeah. than anything else that's been out there.
Well, Jim, you had brought up the idea that there are some parts of where our industry is going right now that people are maligning. One of those would be comments. Let me ask you, are you sick of the inane comments on some news websites? So are the editors, specifically at the Chicago Sun-Times. That's why they decided to get rid of commenting until it could, in their words, fix the morass of negativity, racism, and hate speech. Some are seeing this as a bold move. Others are seeing it something that should have happened a really long time ago, even on a wider scale. What do you guys think?
Too much open season going on in comments. I think comments are being, you know, I was getting really philosophical when I thought about this topic, because, you know, the forum and the open marketplace of ideas and the exchange, you know, when these ideas, were being espoused, you know, a couple of hundred years ago, speech was so valued. Mm-hmm. It was like, I finally get a chance to use my brain and speak my mind. And there was such a premium put on, you know, in the days of Voltaire and, you know, Jefferson. And so now what we've got is we have this belief that we have this right without responsibility to say what we want to say, wherever we want to say, when it, however we think it, without any responsibility or accountability. And I think comments in general need to be reined in and supervised as if it is a kindergarten classroom.
I think you're absolutely right. I think what really brings about the problem is the anonymity. And when people feel like they can say anything they want without any attribution, they don't have to give their names, they can just put a handle up there and then go on about their business, that's where the problem comes. I mean, the trolling, I think, has taken away from the opportunity for people to speak their mind about certain things that are in stories and give their perspective in a clear, concise, and beneficial way, because you've got people that are just trolling and just throwing out hateful speech and racist speech and just...
So is there a way to really fix that, though? 5 years ago, we thought Facebook Connect was going to be the one. So if the, you had to use your real name and your photo showed up there and there was the chance that all of your Facebook friends would see whatever vitriol you put out there, that it would elevate the conversation a little bit, maybe intimidate people into cleaning up their act. But we haven't seen that work even as well as we would have thought that would.
I'm not sure, because once you open up a bottle like that, it's hard to sort of close it down, because all of a sudden people start talking about, well, this is censorship, or you don't really care about what the audience thinks and those types of things. So, I mean, it could get to the point where you have publications that, as the Sun-Times did, just say, you know what, we're just not going to have any comments anymore. We're just going to put the story out there. If you have a comment, you can write in to the editor. You can email the editor. Mm-hmm. We're going to run it on the editorial page. And the only way we're going to do that is if you give us your name, and your address, and we can identify who you are. I mean, it could be one of those situations where we go back to the old days.
Or there will literally be some sort of supervisor who will be monitoring all of it, and there will be, you know,
but
some sort of
that's
database.
Resource heavy.
I agree with you totally. And so it depends on how wed are you to that sort of two-way street kind of communication.
Well, we'll see how long it takes and if the Sun-Times brings comments back and when that happens. A few months ago, we told you about a proposed merger between Comcast and Time Warner. It would amount to the nation's second largest cable company buying up the second largest. Consolidation in the media and communications business isn't funny, though, to Senator Al Franken. The Democrat and former Saturday Night Live writer and performer is leading the way on Capitol Hill, trying to block this deal.
I got over 100,000 people writing me saying, don't allow this to happen.
It's not just consumers, by the way. It's also big media companies. There are CEOs of big media companies that own lots of cable channels that are very concerned about this merger.
Absolutely.
But we haven't heard them speak out.
That speaks volumes about how anti-competitive this is. You know why they don't speak out? They come to my office. They say, this is off the record. And then they talk about how it's going to be anti-competitive.
So you can't tell us who's visited you. You can't name names then.
No, they're afraid of retaliation. I mean, doesn't that tell you everything you need to know?
Franken seems to be fighting this fight all on his own. Doesn't seem to have a whole lot of support in Congress right now on this one.
No, he doesn't. I mean, I watched this interview on Sunday morning, and I found it fascinating that he was bringing up some real serious issues that we discussed on this show back when this was first announced, that it sort of does take away some of the competitiveness of the environment. And the fact that he was willing to go on that show and say, hey, I've got executives coming in and talking to me, and they're concerned about this legislation, and they're concerned about being retaliated against. What bothers me is that he doesn't have any of his colleagues to see this. And I'm wondering if that has a lot to do with, you know, the campaign finance reform and the fact that now corporations are people and there's so much money in the system. Mm-hmm.
And you can watch the full interview on our links blog on KBIA.org. And what was interesting was how it was set up on Reliable Sources on CNN. Brian Stelter went through the members of the Judiciary Committee and listed how much those members were getting in campaign donations from Comcast.
Right.
Sizable amounts in the five figures, some of them.
Noting that they have 100 lobbyists on Capitol Hill alone. You know, what I think is interesting is that this atmosphere of non-competitiveness, you know, according to the numbers that you'll see in that interview, if you go to it, I think Franken cited that 70% of the nation only has one or two choices in a cable provider anyway. So that,
and only one when it comes to broadband.
There you go. And there is where the real battle is. There may be an unbundling, or there may not, of cable sooner or later. That whole over-the-top sort of revolution that a lot of our students are sort of already imbued in may take place sooner or later. But I really think it's in the web where all of this really comes home to roost.
And what I guess what really bothers me, it goes back to that chart that Brian put up, mm-hmm. was the fact that you have this kind of influence on Congress on this issue. Mm-hmm. Think about all the other issues that you have corporations who are basically – I mean, they're paying for influence. I'm not saying that they're actually paying for votes, but they are paying to get a seat at the table to be able to talk to these senators and congressmen about issues such as this that could have a great impact on the everyday lives of Americans.
Now, this is an issue that's been important to Al Franken going back a couple of years. Not so long ago, he also spoke out against the Comcast and NBC merger.
Right.
So the idea of keeping communications industry competitive has always been one he's been front and center on. Since the last time we gathered around this table, the world of late night was shaken up once again, and this time it seems to be ruffling the feathers of some Republicans. David Letterman announced he's retiring in 2015, stepping down as the host of The Late Show, and CBS tapped Stephen Colbert to replace him. Here's Rush Limbaugh's reaction.
CBS has just declared war on the heartland of America. There is no longer is comedy going to be a covert assault on traditional American values, conservatives? Now it's just wide out in the open. What this hire means is a redefinition of what is funny and a redefinition of what is comedy. And they're blowing up the 11:30 format under the guise that the world's changing. And people don't want the kind of comedy that Carson gave us, or even Letterman. They don't want that anymore. It's media planting the flag here.
Now, Rush Limbaugh's stance is obviously going to be from an extreme point of view here, and different from what we've seen in some other places. But maybe that cancel Colbert campaign from a couple weeks ago worked in an unintended way.
Well, I think it's important to note that there is an entire generation that is growing up with Colbert as one of their, frankly, key deliverers of news and comedy. That this is this, you know, I know they're talking about remaking him to make him more like a Tonight. In some respects, maybe they shouldn't, because his product has found its way in a very crowded marketplace, and he has found an audience in a place where people had to go find him. And so, you know, for me, I think what the network is doing is they're saying, we're looking for somebody who's winning in this arena, and he's winning in this arena.
And I think part of it also is they're thinking about the demographic, the changing mm-hmm. demographic. And you're bringing in someone who is going to sort of stretch that demographic out a little bit away from the David Letterman, Jay Leno traditional.
Bringing a more youthful audience,
a more diverse audience. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's important for them. I'm with you, Jim. I think that they're probably going to need to change him a little bit, but I don't think you can change him too much because it loses some of what Stephen Colbert is. And what he himself brings. So there's a certain level of authenticity that needs to be there in order for this to work.
One of the complaints that has been coming from the right is that there are already so many, liberal late night hosts already that are out there. But haven't we seen, you know, for decades that late night hosts still took their jabs at the left when they happened? We saw, you know, Clinton's sex life was prime for late night.
Yeah, this all depends on your perspective, right? I mean, from whence you come is the way that you'll view this. You know, I don't think particularly Colbert's audience necessarily sees him as liberal or conservative.
I think they just see him as funny.
I think they see him as funny, and I think everything's fair game, and I think we've seen that bear itself.
Yeah, I think that this was an opportunity for Limbaugh and those of his ilk to take a jab at the mainstream media, mm-hmm. as they like to call it. But I just don't see how they can say that late night is more liberal than conservative. I think that they take whatever opportunity is available, regardless of which political party is or our politician is in office. If they see an opportunity, they're going to take it.
Equal opportunity poke funners.
That's right. That's right.
If you do something,
if you give them the ammunition, they're going to use it.
Okay. Well, let's talk next about a story that appeared in Washingtonian Mom, a parenting publication in the D.C. area. Features on ABC News reporter Claire Shipman and her husband, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney. And it's raising some eyebrows. Some of the things about the feature are, for lack of a better word, bizarre. Our TV and online audiences are looking at the cover photos of the feature showing Shipman and her children flipping fried eggs in a kitchen with a spread of food on the counter big enough to feed the entire White House press corps. There's another one of the family playing Jenga using a set so large they're building a life-size tower of blocks, and the captions read like a fashion ad telling readers where to buy every stitch of clothing Shipman, Carney, and their children are wearing. So is this a feature story or a fashion spread?
Okay, this is a publication that is catered toward mothers, working mothers, stay-at-home mothers in the Washington, D.C. area who have lifestyles and incomes of a certain range.
Okay.
And this is what you pick up in a doctor's office or a dentist's office and you'd read, and there it is. That's what this article was about. And so when you see all the articles talking about, well, how could Claire Shipman and Jay Carney be involved in something like this? They're a part of that community, and they may have seen, here's an opportunity for us to show this side of our lives as opposed to the other side.
So you think they fry eggs like that normally in the kitchen?
No, not necessarily. If you're going to pick up that magazine, that's what you're going to see.
Yeah, it's for insiders, it's by insiders, and it obviously features insiders. And what's interesting about this, and I think the thing that a lot of people will pick up on, is here's a prominent ABC person who's married to a prominent White House person, and it won't
but
take...
that's standard.
I was, yeah, right. That's it. But that's that insider thing. But it also lends credence to this whole thing of journalism and politicians being too close. There's all sorts of things that people will pick up on. Is it a fashion item or is it a feature item? It's both, but it's definitely intended for a certain audience, a very high level audience.
But here's economically, the other thing. Yeah. How many people outside of the DC bubble are actually reading Washington Mom?
Very, very few.
Right.
Very, very few. The internet has picked up on, and again, this is an issue of the right and the left, everybody kind of having their moment with it, picked up on the fact that there's some artwork in the back of the main photo that shows that they have some Russian propaganda artwork hanging in their home. They had met, you can see it there Claire Shipman's her shoulder, that they had met while both working
in the Moscow.
Right, exactly. And there are some that are saying that, you know, the Obama administration should be out of their mind and angry that that's hanging in their homes.
The problem with this kind of thing is that you're going to pick it apart. I mean, the photos are airbrushed. The whole thing is almost a parody of what is wrong with these high-end publications.
And the text is kind of interesting. And, it's the photos that make you really raise the eyebrow and go, really?
That's it. Yeah. That's it. Because the rest of it's, you know, more or less innocuous.
Yeah, I mean,
innocuous.
They explain why they have this picture in their kitchen and that sort of thing. So it's, I don't know. I enjoyed reading the article, but the photos just had me cracking up. It was really funny.
I can't wait for the day that I have a podium in my home to possibly hold a fake news
field
conference
questions from your children
asking me questions. Well, that music means we're pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we've talked about today on our links blog. You can find that under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again. Leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.